from the high desert and the great American Southwest. I bid you all good evening, good afternoon, good morning, I don't know, whatever time it is and whatever time zone you reside in, every single one of them covered in one way or the other by this incredible program called Coast to Coast AM. This is the weekend edition, and I'm Art Bell. Howdy. We've got so much going on tonight that's going to interest you. As you know, we almost lost Ann Streber. She had one heck of a near-death experience, and it involves her cat. So it's a really interesting one, the only one like this that I have ever heard, ever. And so we'll get to Ann. Ann's going to actually be on the air with us here in a moment. A few station-keeping items. One, the predictions this year for the year 2005 are going to begin tomorrow night. That's right. Tomorrow night I have exactly... I'm going to be off Christmas weekend. I'm going to have that weekend off and enjoy Christmas with Ramona and family. And so the predictions, therefore, are going to be tomorrow night and then on December 31st. I will indeed be here to escort you all into the new year. I think that's a Friday night, Saturday morning, if I'm not mistaken. I think it is. And so, as we have done traditionally, we'll do 2 days of predictions. Those days will be tomorrow night, Sunday, and then December 31st. We'll finish them off. Now, I'd like to take a moment to do what I think is worth doing, and that is tomorrow night when I begin the predictions, and I'll, of course, pull the predictions made last year for 2004 from the Bell Family Vault. In fact, actually, I have them right here. One of them on the first page is astounding. I mean, it's right on the mark, just absolutely astounding. You'll have to wait till tomorrow night to find out about that one. We'll read those and take them. Now, I want you to do your very darn level best, please, to not just call me for the sake of getting on the air and hearing your voice on the air. I really want those of you who have a given gift for making predictions to use the time between now and tomorrow night to concentrate on what you really feel will occur in the year 2005. And so give it a little thought. Don't just sort of make a snap and dial judgment. Really give it a little thought, those of you who have talent for such. And let's bring our average up. So that'll begin tomorrow night. That's item one. Item two is, so many times he makes my webcam. Well, tonight he's done it again. That's my cat, or one of my four cats, our four cats. This one's name is Yeti. And the photograph you're going to see represents something that happened last night. It shouldn't be possible. It should not be possible. However, last night this cat made a 7 1/2 foot jump into the most incredible little area. This is an area between our bedroom and our bathroom. And there's this little tiny narrow area, I suppose for air or whatever, above the bathroom doors. And the door was open. He was in the bathroom. The door was open, so he didn't have to make this jump. This was a volunteer jump that you're witnessing. I was laying on the bed, petting another cat, which may have led him to do this, to show off a little, to get attention. I don't know. Whatever the reason, he decided he was going to make what I consider to be one of the most incredible cat jumps ever made by a cat. Now, I don't know if you can make it out in the photograph that's on my webcam, but this area between the top of the ridge there and the ceiling is about as big as a cat. That's it. In other words, his little hump of a back is about on the ceiling. And the whole area is, it's only a cat width wide. So to have jumped 7.5 feet and have landed, to have landed where he did, is one of the more outstanding feats I've ever seen a cat perform. So I ran and got the camera and took a picture, and there it is. That's Yeti. 7.5 feet. Straight up into an area that, I mean, the whole jump is just, in my mind, impossible. So that's on the webcam tonight. Item three, and last item before we launch here. Well, actually, there's a fourth. Showtime, I've heard rumors that Showtime is going to cancel Dead Like Me. What the hell is up with that? That happens to be one of my favorite programs, and they haven't given it long enough to catch on properly because it's a little bit different. Well, okay, a lot different. It's a wonderful television program, and Showtime, if it's true, shame on you! And you need to change your mind and put it back on. George needs to be on Showtime. And if not, then I hope HBO grabs it out from under you. That'd be my wish. And then the only item, the news item worth mentioning, is this incredible story. You know, the woman charged with killing an expectant mother and cutting the baby from her womb was showing the child off to people at a cafe and to her pastor hours before she was arrested, residents said Saturday. Lisa M. Montgomery, 36 years of age, charged with kidnapping resulting in murder and was expected to appear in federal court Monday. The baby, whose mother had been 8 months pregnant, was in good condition. And that's the king of the shake-your-head stories of the horrible things that happen in the world. Something not quite so horrible, something wonderful, has happened with Ann Streber. In a moment, that story. By the way, in the hour coming up, top of the next hour, we're going to have Dr. Charles Till here, who designed the first Canadian reactor, nuclear reactor. I said the first Canadian nuclear reactor, then came down here and helped us set up. And he's got a lot of thoughts on what ought to be done about energy in America, nuclear power, and all the rest of it. That's going to be really good. But right now, you know, it doesn't seem like very long ago, or does it, that I called Whitley Strieber, who was about to come on the air with me on this program, and I called him about, 10 minutes before the show, and he said, "Oh, my God, Art." And then I heard this rustling on the line, and it hung up, and I called back immediately, and Whitley just said, "Ann's collapsed. I've got to go," and hung up. And what a story from there. Ladies and gentlemen, one of my best friends, my co-author, here is Whitley Strieber. Whitley?
Hi, Art. And it was a remarkable moment, and that you would call just at the second, literally,
yeah,
that it was happening. That we had just in that moment walked into the apartment, and suddenly Ann, walking in front of me, said, "Whitley, I need your help." And her knees were buckling. And I took her down to the floor. You called. I said what I just said. You called back. I explained she'd collapsed. And the next moment, I realized that, astonishingly enough, she was having, at first I thought perhaps she was in hypoglycemic shock because we hadn't eaten all day. But then I could see she was having a seizure, and it was obvious that it was a brain bleed. And I knew what I was up against, that I had perhaps half an hour to get her to the hospital, and that at this moment my wife's life was in jeopardy. It was a 50-50 chance of surviving that half hour. Those were the statistics. I knew all of this because it happened to my sister about 3 years ago.
That's so frightening. God, I can't even imagine.
And, you know, the astonishing and deeply sobering thing is it came out of nowhere. She was perfectly fine 5 seconds before it happened. And
well, that is the nature of something happening in your brain.
Yeah.
Whitley, the long story told short, what happened to Ann, and of course there were different reports at the beginning, as there always are in an incident like this, until the final word came in, but
yeah,
what had actually happened?
Well, she had an undiagnosed aneurysm in her brain, which is a swelling in one of the blood vessels. It had probably been there all of her life.
Well, that's like a time bomb.
Like a time bomb. And it just
It's like a balloon. In other words, the vein becomes like a balloon, and then like a balloon overblown, it finally bursts.
Right. And it was simply an accident waiting to happen. And the irony of it was that it had happened to my sister. So I was very aware of this danger in people. But it never crossed either of our minds that Annie might be in jeopardy with this. Never. And she had no symptoms. Sometimes people do have symptoms of this. They have headaches or
something,
double vision or other symptoms that suggest this. But we didn't. She didn't have any symptoms.
Well, again, long story short, you got her to the hospital. We began to get reports. And, of course, we had people do a mass prayer. And also, I guess there was some actual medical assistance as a result of your being on the program, right?
Well, that's right, Art. And that's one of the reasons we're here tonight, is both of us want to thank you and the listeners. Because, first of all, there were two nurses. We made a desperate appeal on that night, I did, for help. Because here we were in the middle of Los Angeles, a city we don't really know very well, at a strange hospital with no knowledge of how it worked, and I knew only that my wife was in tremendous jeopardy. And I got on the air, and God love them, two crucially important nurses heard this, threw their clothes on, and came over to the hospital and acted as ombudsman for us all through that night and helped us in every way, and a wonderful doctor. The hospital was the Kaiser Permanente on Sunset, and I have to tell you that they performed superbly well in stabilizing Anne and getting her out of immediate danger. Throughout the whole thing, the medical care we've received in Los Angeles has been fantastic.
My understanding is, Woodley, correct me if I'm wrong, but they put something into her leg, guided it all the way through a blood vessel to her brain, and then put something in there.
Yes.
You know, I mean, once the blood vessels burst, then you're going to bleed and bleed and bleed unless they do something. So they put something in there, right?
Well, what happened was, first, at Kaiser Permanente, they increased the pressure of her spinal fluid in her, the fluid in her around her brain, so that the bleeding would stop.
Mm-hmm.
Leaving the aneurysm kind of hanging there. And it could have burst, and it could have gotten worse. And we spent about 18 hours struggling to find a doctor who could put something called a coil in it, because it was a very, very difficult one to reach. Mm-hmm. Finally, it turned out that the doctor who developed the process, it was at UCLA Medical Center. And so down there she went in an ambulance. And the next night, Sunday night, she was coiled, and they put this thing in her leg and went all the way up through her body's circulatory system into this tiny little blood vein in her brain, put this coil in. And the doctor, before he started, he said, it's going to be very challenging and expect to be waiting about 3 hours.
Hmm.
40 minutes later, he called and said, it's done and it's stable and you have nothing further to worry about. And I said, Doctor, are you running out of challenges? I hope not.
Hey, I'm curious about something, Whitley. I remember that I was hypertensive about the whole thing, and I got an email from somebody, and for some reason the email struck me as really important. I won't give but there was a doctor's name in the email, and they wanted this passed on to you, so I called you and passed it on to you. Where did that fit into all this?
Art, that email. And the lady who, I hope she's listening tonight, who sent that, we've had correspondence since. It was crucial. That email introduced me to a wonderful man, Dr. Miles Saunders, who has become a close friend, who functioned as a consultant throughout this, who helped us through the process of getting her into UCLA Medical Center, which is not easy to do because they have lots of people trying to get in there all the time.
Sure.
It's one of the leading places in the world for this type of surgery. Getting her to the right physicians. He is a neurosurgeon himself, has now retired but in practice for many years. And every step of the way, I was able to call Miles and find out from him where we were, what was going on, and time again, it turned out that our doctors had anticipated a possible problem and headed it off at the pass. So what we are looking at here now, and what I'm sitting here looking at right now, is a real miracle.
She's home, right? I mean, she's right there with you.
Right there with me, a miracle of two things, modern medicine and, in my opinion, prayer. The prayer of many people who are listening to this now. Because modern medicine told me it would take 6 months to a year for Annie to fully recover.
Sure. Usually there's a paralysis, physical paralysis.
Well, not
involved.
Necessarily this, physical paralysis in this case.
Or mental problems.
A lot of cognitive problems.
Of course, yeah.
But now here sitting across from me, not a year later or 6 months later, but 8 days after she walked out of the hospital, is a normal Ann Streamer.
This is the whole thing.
Absolutely astonishing.
It is astonishing.
Yes.
And of course, then what happened to her that we only learned about fairly recently is also absolutely astonishing. So why don't you go ahead and put Ann on with us, and we'll start this story.
Okay. I just want to say one thing about her more. She's also a novelist. Her first novel, The Invisible Woman, is just out. An Invisible Woman is just out. And I'll let her talk about that and everything else. Here she is.
All right.
Hey, Art.
Hey, Ann. Welcome back to the world.
Oh, thank you. Thank you very much.
When this occurred to you, there was nothing, as Whitley said, there was nothing beforehand, no headaches, no warning, nothing. It just, what happened? You just started suddenly feeling dizzy or what?
I tell you the truth, I don't really know what happened since I don't remember any of it.
Oh, all of that's a blank, huh?
Yes, yes it is. I mean, I have a few vague memories, but basically I don't remember it, and I probably never will.
And what was the last thing you do remember? I mean, do you remember the night, the evening, then coming home? Where did you lose it?
Well, I don't remember coming home and collapsing. I remember we went to a movie.
Okay.
But I did want to say real quick, you know, science has been studying the power of prayer. And they have decided, most scientists have decided that there's a legitimate power to it. They don't know why.
Oh, yes.
But they do know that people who are prayed for get better.
That's right. That is now proven.
Yeah.
Just proven statistically.
Yeah.
That's all there is to it. Sure.
Yeah. And I wanted to thank people who prayed for me, because I mean, I know there's a real power to it, and I appreciate those prayers so much, and I appreciate what you did so much.
You're very welcome. As I told Whit, I was kind of hypertensive over the whole thing. Ramona and I both were, and you know, if you look at, as we have so closely, because I guess we're so close to it, I mean, there were a remarkable number of almost miracles and coincidences that occurred in connection with this whole thing, and the fact that
a whole series of miracles, right? A whole series. Starting off with the fact that my husband was so brave, he saved my life. I mean, that's just flat out the way it is. He saved my life.
You know, he was not only brave, but he was directed, Anne. In other words, like a laser beam, he was on exactly what had to be done.
Yes, he was, and it was just miraculous. I don't know. I mean, I don't know where he got the insight and strength, and but thank goodness he did. But now I wonder if you are interested in hearing about my trip to the land of the dead.
Oh, absolutely. I am interested. That's sort of half the reason you're here, if not the biggest reason you're here tonight, is you did apparently experience, I don't know, was it a, would you call it a near-death experience, or?
Well, it wasn't your traditional near-death experience with the white light and things like that. You know, I had been reading a book recently that was basically a book of interviews with different shaman, and it was saying that one thing every single shaman who has ever lived has in common is the choice, they make a conscious choice to enter the land of the dead, or to have a near-death experience.
Hmm.
And so not that I'm a shaman, I'm not. I don't have the wisdom for it, but it's just interesting to me that this happened to me too. We had this crazy cat, Ko, the Siamese cat, and Ko was a cat with no instincts.
All right, this is a very important story, and we're at the bottom of the hour, so
okay. We'll
just leave everybody hanging. That's what we do in talk radio, is we let people hang when the really important part's coming. So hang away. Clock says we have to do that. Ann Strieber is my guest right now. She is a miracle. You're listening to a miracle. The fact that she is here is absolutely a miracle, and the nature of the near-death experience she had... Well, you heard her mention her cat, Ko, and we have discussed cats and dogs and animals and souls and near death a lot. Well, we're going to wrap it all into one here in a moment.
At area code 775-727-1295. The first-time caller line is area code 775-727-1222. To talk with Art Bell from East of the Rockies, call toll-free at 800-825-5033. From West of the Rockies, call Art at 800-618-8255. International callers may reach Art Bell by calling your in-country Sprint access number, pressing option 5. And dialing toll-free 800-893-0903. From coast to coast and worldwide on the Internet, this is Coast to Coast AM with Art Bell.
The existence of God, life, death, our souls, whether there is a physical attachment of something that detaches when we die, and whether, in fact, there's an afterlife. All of this, these are the greatest mysteries of our life. If you want a little hint about what might be, it's coming up in just a moment with Ann Strieber. Ann Strieber is back, and I don't even begin to know how to ask Ann about her experience, so I really don't, Ann. I mean, there's no way to just jump into this. What happened?
Well, I was talking a little about Ko, and the funny thing about Ko was that he was a cat with attitude. I remember one time I was in the living room and I heard this huge crash. And I ran over to my son's bedroom, where it's where the crash had come from. And Cole comes out and he yawns as if he's just been woken up, when obviously he's the one who did it.
Whoa, I have no idea what that was.
Yeah. And I thought, busy. That cat lied to me. That cat lied.
Yes. Well, that's what it was. It was a concocted, well thought out, presented lie.
Another time he got out in the middle of the winter, escaped, you know, from our country house, and he was out all night. We worried to death, and our son was away at school, and we thought, oh God, he's going to come home and there'll be no cat. You know, his pet is gone, and finally he came back, and of course, Art, you know the first thing he did when he came home, don't you?
Yes.
He used the cat box.
Well, at least he used the box.
I mean, this cat had so few instincts, he couldn't even pee in the woods.
Well, Anne, here's what I've said on the air and what I feel. I have four cats, as you know, and they all have, I've watched them so carefully, they have a sense of themselves. I've got one that admires himself in the mirror and practices looking cute. Okay, that's an important thing, a sense of self. And they have distinct personalities. They're as different as two people's personalities could be from each other. They have every emotion, it seems like, as same as humans. In other words, all these crucial things that to me add up to what we call a personality or a soul. I'm not sure.
They really do.
Not sure what the Bible says about this, but from my point of view, they're as full of soul as we are. Now, go ahead. What happened?
Well, what happened was, I was in a room all of a sudden, and there were people with shopping bags and suitcases, and I heard a voice saying to me, "You can keep going if you want to." And of course, you know what that meant.
Yes, of course. Wait, did you? Now I've got some questions. For example, at that moment, Anne, did you know the situation you were in?
No. No, I didn't.
Did you know that you were hanging between life and death?
No, I didn't. No. But I knew I was in the world of the dead. That sounds odd, but I did. I knew it. I knew I was in the world of the dead. And my son was standing by my bed, but I thought I was talking to him on a cell phone, which is very odd. But turns out he was standing by the bed, and I said to him, "Andrew, guess what? Co is here."
Co, your cat.
No. Yes, I was so surprised. I said, "This is incredible. Co is here, Andrew."
Is Co still alive, Anne?
No. Co had cancer, and you know, but here's the odd thing. When I was talking to Andrew, who was standing by my bed, but I thought I was talking to him on the cell phone, I said, "I thought it would be my mother. I thought it would be my dead mother, but it's Co."
Wow.
Because my mother committed suicide when I was 7. I've always thought that if I ever got near a place like the world of the dead, I'd be able to ask her some questions.
But she wasn't there.
No, it was Co.
It was your
cat. It was good old Co.
Do you specifically, I guess, understand that statement or that, statement, "You can stay or you can go on," came from Co. Was there any question?
Well, no, that didn't come from Co. It was just like a voice.
It was just a voice.
It was just a voice saying, if you can keep going if you want to. And, of course, I knew that meant that if I wanted to die, I could go ahead and do it.
Then you felt the presence of Co, or actually
saw him.
You saw Co.
Oh, yeah, I saw him right there. And he kind of had this attitude like, "Oh, these stupid humans, they can't even find a world of the dead on their own." You know what I mean? I mean, I just feel that coming off him. You know, I mean, he was always like that. And, but, you know, we went to the world of the dead, and he showed it to me. And I think he brought me back from it.
Oh, you think he brought you back?
Oh, yes,
Do you recall, I mean, that was a statement to you that you could stay or you could progress, you could keep going. Do you recall making a conscious decision?
Yes, I do. I recall making a conscious decision not to die.
Huh.
Although, you know, when you're in a certain position in life, it can be very tempting, can seem very restful. I've known people who have had near-death experiences who said they didn't want to come back. They didn't want to live. They were very happy.
That's right. Was there a draw on that side? Do you remember the feeling?
No, there wasn't. No. I wasn't appalled or anything, or frightened even, but I just decided that I didn't want to die now. But it wasn't Coe's voice I was hearing. It was kind of like a universal voice or a God voice or whatever, telling me that I could keep going if I wanted to.
Right. Right. And you were conscious as you are now. In other words, recognizing, did you have form and substance? You said you saw people.
Yeah, I saw people, and I think I had form and substance. Seemed like to me I did, and Coe certainly did.
This is an incredible story. I have never talked to anybody who has had a near-death experience and met. Were you really close? Did you have a really close love relationship with Coe?
Well, Coe was great. I remember when he finally died, he had cancer. You know, we took him to a surgeon, and the surgeon, you know, just couldn't fix him up. And
yeah.
I remember he kept Coe alive so I could say goodbye to him. And I went in, and he was, you know, lying on the operating table. And
He'd got
his lungs inflated so he could still breathe. And I remember putting my face in his fur and just weeping. And then I was weeping on that poor man's shoulder. And I remember thinking to myself, this poor vet, all he does all day is probably try to take cancer out of cats. And then people weep on his shoulder.
Then your love relationship with that cat was enormous then.
Oh, I was crazy about Coe. And I remember thinking to myself when I saw him again, I remember thinking to myself, well, you know, maybe all those years of changing the litter and feeding him does pay off.
That's an interesting thought to have had. This is remarkable. And so,
you know what else I thought? It's very funny. I saw Coe, and I thought to myself, it's that damn cat.
Well, you still had a sense of humor then.
I really did. I remember thinking that. I remember thinking, it's that damn cat.
I guess then the intensity of the love that you had for Coe was perhaps closer to the top of the ladder than what you remembered of your mom because of the early suicide. And that's why Coe was there. I don't know.
I don't know at all. I mean, you know, I really, when you're abandoned by your mother, which is what it seems like when that happens, it's very strange. It's a very strange experience. It feels like abandonment. You know, if you've ever been a motherless child, and you're a motherless child forever, and I can even spot them. I can spot adults who lost their mothers early. I've always said I can, and I think I can, because we're all motherless. We're forever motherless. And I always promised myself I would never do that to my son, no matter how bad things got.
Sure. And when you...
My mother was what's called bipolar.
I know what that is, yes.
Yeah, it used to be called manic depressive.
Yes, very tough periods of being almost hyper up and then hyper down and not much in between.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Pretty tough. Okay. When you made the decision to live, did anything then happen? Were you suddenly out of that area? Was Coe gone, and were you back among the living, or what?
Trying to remember. It seems like I was. But it wasn't really zippy. It wasn't like zoom, zoom, zoom. I do think I saw God.
Oh?
But, you know, I think that when we see God, we see the God that we, I don't want to say believe in, but are interested in. And I'm very interested in quantum physics. So I saw a God who was kind of like a random number generator.
Huh.
And I don't mean that he was, you know, cold or but I just mean that it was kind of like the explanation he was giving me for who he is. It was kind of like someone who controls randomness.
Well, that would be us humans. We're plenty random, aren't we? This free will thing has us all over the board, so.
Yeah, well, yes, but I think that, you know, it's interesting. You were talking about God a little earlier, and it is Christmas and everything, and I was thinking to myself, you know, I think that Jesus was a shaman who came down and voluntarily had a near-death experience so that we would all know that we didn't have to be afraid of death.
And that's the next big question. Has this changed you in any way? Humans have a fear of their own mortality. There's no question about it. Has it changed the way you feel?
I don't think so. I don't think so. I've met many people who say I'm not afraid of death anymore.
That's right.
I'm not sure if I am or not, really. I'm really not sure.
Huh.
I was just so grateful to be brought back. And it was such an adventure to be brought back by Co. I think that really I didn't have time to stop and think about that.
Do you think that means cats have souls, animals have souls? Is that what that means?
Well, I really don't know. I would be kind of surprised if they didn't.
So would I. And I think it does. But what an unusual near-death experience to have.
It was, wasn't it?
Did you recall then who'd you tell about it, and how quickly were you able to?
I told Andrew almost immediately. Of course, he heard me say that about Co.
Right.
He was standing right there, and I said that. And later he told me I'd said that, and I did remember saying it.
That's very important. I mean, that's a little bit of additional evidence. So this came out of your mouth.
Oh, yes. No, I said that. I said, Andrew, Co is here. Guess what? Co is here.
Wow.
Yeah, and while he was standing right there, I thought I was talking to him on a cell phone. Why I thought that, I don't know, because I can barely work my cell phone.
Right.
But he remembers me saying it, and he was standing by. He said, no, Mom, no, I was standing right by your bed, and you said that, and I heard you say that. I thought that was so odd. And he said, and you also said, I thought it would be my dead mother. He remembers the whole thing.
Oh, you said that out loud as well.
Yes, I said it all out loud, and he remembers the whole thing very clearly. In fact, he's the one who told me about the dead mother part. I had forgotten that.
Well, this is really something. And then I guess you finally got to tell Whit, huh?
Yep.
How are you feeling now?
Well, I tell you, it's interesting. I am... right now, I'm a person who I've had some existential confusion. I mean, it takes me a while to remember what day it is, what date it is, what year it is, where the bathroom is. And I have to use cues for that. I have to use like therapy. I have to make sure I look at the paper and see what the date is, and then I have to remember. Oh, so-and-so was here on Tuesday, so it must be Wednesday. I mean, it's the basic things take a lot more work than they used to.
Well, I'm told that this sort of thing, following what happened to you, will fade, and you will return to 100% normal.
Yeah, well, I'm pretty normal now, actually.
You sound like
The funny thing is it seems to have affected my... small brains. I mean, the brains that kind of function in an everyday way.
Yes.
But it didn't affect my big brains at all. I'm still very able to talk about philosophy, quantum physics, all those things I used to, religion, all those things I used to love to talk about. Ask me why that is, because I really do not know. I mean, I can sit down and talk to you about philosophy or anything like that, even though maybe I can't, don't remember where the bathroom is.
All right, you wrote all of this in Anne's diary, which is on unknowncountry.com. It's still there, isn't it, Anne?
Yeah, yes it is.
Okay, a wonderful piece. I recommend it to everybody. And now you've written a book, is that right?
I've written a book called An Invisible Woman, and it's in bookstores right now. It's being published by Tor. And it's a thriller about a woman whose husband is murdered, and she sets out to discover who killed him, and what's interesting about this, at least to me, is I became invisible. This really happened to me.
Oh. I'm sorry, I don't mean to interrupt. Anne, anything's likely to occur now. When something as traumatic as what happened to you happens to somebody, they occasionally come back with insights and abilities that last for a period of time and then fade, but some very unusual abilities following these near-death things.
Well, this all happened to me before I had this accident. But what happened to me is we were living in New York at the time, and I would go out to do chores because, you know, you do them on foot in New York City. You know, you walk from here to there.
Mm-hmm.
And I kept getting these horrible fights with strange men in stores because they would step in front of me, right in front of me when I was standing in line at the deli. They would step right in front of me when I was trying to catch a cab. I mean, it was just, and I kept saying to myself, what's going on? And Whitley was actually scared because every time I'd go out again, I'd get a big fight with somebody. And then I kicked this one man in the deli who stepped in front of me, and he called the police.
Well, you were in New York.
Yeah, well, nobody. This never had happened to me before in New York.
Oh, I see.
I mean, people may not be terribly polite, but, I mean, you know, they're not. And it was all men. It was always kind of, always men doing it.
Well, they have a very hurried lifestyle.
Well, but I think it was more than that, Art, I have to tell you. And then I found out that there's actually a scientific reason for this. And what it is that we all have these sex hormones or signals that we're sending out called pheromones. And as a woman gets older, these start to diminish. And so what happens is you are literally off the male radar. They literally cannot see you.
Oh. Oh, that makes us sound so terrible, Anne.
No, I really don't mean that. I really don't mean that. But it was an interesting realization because, I mean, it just kept happening to me. And I remember we finally had to get our lawyer after that man called the police. And I mean, I kicked him right in the shin. And then the lawyer said to me, Anne, please don't kick people in the deli. You know? But it's really happened to me. Here's another example that happened to me. We were going out to dinner with some movie people, and Whitley was saying, I wish I knew what they really thought about my project. And I said to him, well, why don't you just excuse yourself to go to the men's room, and I'll just sit there, and they'll all talk about it right in front of me, and then I'll report back to you later.
Okay, we're out of time. End of the story is they did?
They did, and I reported back. I was a spy in my own life.
Welcome back, Anne.
Thanks.
It's been a pleasure having you on. Tell Whit I'll talk to him shortly. And again, welcome back to the world, my dear.
Thanks a lot.
Good night.
Good night.
That's Anne Streber. That's got to be one of the more unusual near-death experiences you've ever heard. Certainly true for me. In a moment, we're going to talk about what's headed toward my backyard. I'm Art Bell.
At area code 775-727-1295. The first time caller line is area code 775-727-1222. To talk with Art Bell from east of the Rockies, call toll free at 800-825-5033. From west of the Rockies, call 800-618-8255. International callers may reach Art by calling your in-country Sprint access number, pressing option 5, and dialing toll-free 800-893-0903. From coast to coast and worldwide on the Internet, this is Coast to Coast AM with Art Bell.
Raging across America and the world, and America and the world desperately need energy. And I mean desperately. A lot of controversy about peak oil. You know what peak oil means? It means we've got as much as we're going to get, baby. And from here on in, it's going to be less, and it's going to get expensive real fast. The world needs energy desperately. Coming up, Dr. Charles Till, who was an engineer, listen carefully, an engineer and a physicist when he left Canada to finish his technical education at the Imperial College, University of London. When he returned to Canada, he was given the job of starting up the first Canadian power reactor. He was just 26 years of age at the time, fresh out of school. A couple of years later, he accepted a position at Argonne National Laboratory out of Chicago, where civilian reactor development for the U.S. was then concentrated. He is now retired, but for almost 20 years, he led a large research and development program at one of our nation's great national laboratories. His goal? Nothing less than to develop a wholly new kind of nuclear reactor technology. He wanted that technology to solve the problems facing nuclear power, to allow nuclear power to take its place in a long-term solution for our nation's energy needs, and they are desperate indeed. With our nation facing very serious problems because of our increasing dependence upon oil and with sober predictions of a coming peak oil in production in the next decade or so, and then a slow, and I might add painful, and expensive decline, the story of Dr. Till's work is one well worth telling and one well worth your rapt attention in a moment. Well, all right, then. Here we go. Welcome, Dr. Charles Till.
Well, thank you.
It's great to have you with us. Dr. Till, where are you?
I'm in Idaho Falls on a very pleasant night, at midnight here in Idaho, I would say.
Okay, excellent. So a little bit then about yourself. How does one, particularly early on like that, get into the nuclear power field?
Well, you must remember the time. A long time ago, the 1950s, nuclear energy was the way of the future. It was accepted by pretty much everyone, the professionals, scientists, public. In fact, I think too much was expected of it, if anything. Nuclear power was supposed to...
Save us.
Save us, yeah. It'd be an endless source of electricity. Famously, electricity too cheap to meter. The public was very supportive. You know, heaven knows the introduction of nuclear couldn't have been more dramatic in the form of the bomb, but it was, you know, it's rather like introducing fire through TNT.
Well, in that way, though, the world's people understood the power involved.
Yes. I think very early the understanding of what the potential was correctly publicized. You know, the first time that I had was conscious of it, I was 11 years old. And in school, I gave a little talk on the benefits of nuclear power, which, by the way, I cribbed out of the Saturday Evening Post, and I was most worried about whether I'd memorized it properly than anything else. But still, it gives an idea of the sort of popularity of it at the time. Later on, when I'd gone into engineering and then into physics, it was the... In a sense, idealistic. One had a chance to do something important.
Oh, that's important, all right. Yeah. Very important. So,
yeah.
So you helped put together the Canada's first nuclear reactor. Is that correct?
Well, you gave me a little bit too much credit in the very early things you said. The designer of the Canadian reactor was a wonderful scientist and engineer, W. B. Lewis. My job was to, after I came out of school, to come back to Canada, was to study that reactor, which was under construction, and then be the physicist in charge of bringing the thing into operation.
That's pretty serious.
It was a challenge for a kid my age, and I learned a lot from it. today or even a decade after that, you would never have given a, essentially a young man like that to that kind of responsibility.
Doctor, that early in all of this, even at that stage, were you as a physicist concerned with what you were doing? In other words, not just the fact that you could create the power and you could cause a chain reaction and do what you were supposed to do, but did you begin thinking at that early stage, I've always wondered about this, about the consequences of it and about the byproducts of it and all the rest of that that we're going to have to talk about. Did any of that occur to you that early on?
The principal thing, of course, that bothered one was the use of it as a weapon. It wasn't the waste. It wasn't even that you couldn't solve perfectly adequately the safety of it, of a power reactor.
Mm-hmm.
If you had a crisis of conscience, it was strictly
the weapon part.
The weapons aspect of it.
So you all then weren't thinking too much about the waste aspect of it.
No. That was in fact one of the, as we will get on, I'm sure, later in the program, that was one of the principal weaknesses in the way civilian nuclear was developed.
Hmm.
In that it was assumed that if one could make the reactor itself economic, that was the big step, and that the rest that must come along, the processing of the spent fuel and the disposing of the waste, that would come in good time.
Hmm.
Plenty of time, no hurry with that.
Remember,
that turned out to be a bad misjudgment.
Yes, do you recall early in the interview, a few moments ago, I asked you where you were, and you told me, now let me tell you where I am. I'm in Pahrump, Nevada. That's where I live.
Rather significant.
So tonight's program is of a fair amount of importance to me. I'm just over the hill and over the dale from Yucca Mountain.
Correct.
And so I guess we'll get to all of that. Nevertheless, what a wonderful job you would have had to be making sure that this thing was going to work. In Canada, were you building reactors the way we built them here in the U.S.? Were they double shielded?
Double contained?
Yes.
No.
Really? Really?
There is a containment of a kind of on the Canadian reactors, but it isn't the the one that will take large overpressures that we have on our water reactors here.
Oh, no kidding. Now, when you designed this, Doctor, was it in your mind that everything was going to be so backed up and it was going to be done so carefully that nothing could go wrong?
Well, again, let me stress that the Canadian design was done by basically W.B. Lewis and a lot of very good people.
Right.
It wasn't my
Understood.
Responsibility, although I would have been proud to have done it. The principal argument building the Canadian heavy water reactors that way was that although things could go wrong, that nothing of a nature to really threaten the fuel integrity. If the fuel stays intact, there is no accident. We can get into that a little bit, but the fuel is in rods in the reactor,
right?
And it's in either steel or some inert material, metal like that. And as long as the steel clad or the metal clad stays intact, of course, there is no accident. No serious accident, no release of radioactivity. And so the principal arguments that the Canadians made and make is that there is no accident that is credible that would affect the fuel, to fail the fuel. And over the years, that has turned out to be so.
Has it?
I think it was a pretty good idea.
In Canada or worldwide?
No, in Canada.
In
that specific kind of reactor.
Oh,
the Canadian kind of reactor is specialized to Canada. It's built one or two other places, but it's fundamentally a Canadian development.
All right, what's different between a Canadian reactor, for example, and a U.S. reactor or a Russian reactor?
Well, the principal reactor that took over the world's generation of electricity is the American light water reactor, so-called.
Mm-hmm.
And it is a reactor that is fundamentally the submarine, the reactor that was developed by Admiral Rickover for the submarine. It's basically that reactor built large.
Okay.
And it has enriched fuel. That is to say that the fissionable material in these reactors starts out to be, in any case, uranium-235, the fissionable isotope of uranium.
Mm-hmm.
And in natural uranium, that's in present only in perhaps 0.75%. The rest is inert. So in the U.S. reactors and the submarine reactors, the enrichment can be 3%, 4%, something like that. Mm-hmm. The point in mentioning that is that in order to build those reactors, you have to have the ability to enrich, precisely what Iran is arguing about right now.
Mm-hmm.
And in Canada, there was no wish to build an enrichment plant, so that they designed reactors that would operate on the natural uranium, the uranium with just 0.75% U-235 content.
So you don't need to enrich it.
So you don't need, and what that involved was a rather difficult process to use what is called heavy water, a form of water, looks like ordinary water, but does not absorb neutrons like the ordinary water does.
I believe heavy water is used to store spent fuel rods, is it not?
No, no. You would never use it for that. It's far too expensive.
Oh.
It has to be created through a rather special process.
Okay.
And so to try to pin down the difference then between those two kinds of reactors and then the Russian reactor on the third peg, let me think for a minute. The Canadian reactors operate, as I said, on natural uranium. And they have a methodology of continuously fueling the thing, whereas the American reactors operate, as I said, with slightly enriched fuel, and they are shut down to refuel. And the Canadian reactors rely on the arguments for safety that we just said. Mm-hmm. The American reactors have heavy containment.
What is the difference in safety when you talk about the Canadian design versus the American? What's the difference? How much difference in safety factor is there?
I would guess not a lot when you added it all up. But I don't think in this country we will ever build reactors without heavy containment.
No, I don't think. In fact, I'm not even sure about continuing to build reactors, period, without any kind of containment.
Yeah, well, the point is, if you don't, then what alternatives do you have? I guess, and that was the point you were making earlier. But it does depend on what kind of reactors that one builds, obviously, as well. The Russian reactors were of two types, and are of two types. One is very similar to our water reactor. The other is a graphite reactor that was Chernobyl, and that was one of the most primitive early forms of a reactor. It would work, but But it, in my view, it should never have been built as a power-producing reactor.
How many of these kinds of reactors are still being operated in Russia? Do you know?
On the order of a dozen.
Oh, my God. And so the original danger is still there times 12, huh?
Well, I think the better way, perhaps, of putting it is that if those reactors are operated with some common sense,
yes,
they'll probably be all right. There have been changes made in them to make them less touchy than they were in 86 when the Chernobyl tragedy happened.
The whole Chernobyl thing is incredible. I had somebody sent me a link once of this young lady who took a motorcycle ride or something through the Chernobyl area. This was fairly recent. And the amount of land now useless, the amount of abandoned homes, and it's just incredible. It is taking that little picture tour of what this young lady saw riding through the Chernobyl.
Yeah.
It was just chilling. The whole thing was big time chilling. How much land is unusable now?
Yes, I don't know the answer to that, but
a lot.
But what you had, yes, a lot. But what you had was the worst possible reactor accident. You know, you had the thing wide open to the sky and burning for days on end. It was just revolting.
And, well, a lot of the world thought no such thing could really ever happen until that moment. I mean, I suppose it was, you know, there was some science fiction talk about it, but...
The graphite reactor has its own safety problems. The graphite reactors were built in the earliest days because the materials were cheap and it was fairly simple to do. They're sort of like the Stanley steamer. Well, they would work, but there's a lot better ways of making cars.
Well, while we're on the subject of Chernobyl, where is Chernobyl today? I mean, they put this giant casket thing over it of concrete, right?
Yes.
So what's going on? Do you know? Do you keep up on it?
I haven't really followed it in recent years. My guess, is for what it's worth, is that efforts still continue to make sure that the sarcophagus, as it's called, is stable, and that the other reactors on the site are operated to provide the power that it was needed in that area. My guess is that's where it is. But
I saw a 60 Minutes piece in which they said the sarcophagus is not at all stable.
And well, it certainly, what I do know is that that was always true of it, and it needed to be, reinforced, et cetera, et cetera.
For how long will these protections have to be in place, assuming they hold?
Oh, a very long time.
What do you mean by a very long time?
I would guess unless there is a superhuman effort to clean it up, which
yes.
is certainly possible. But if it's left the way it is,
yes.
you'd have to leave it there for thousands of years.
Thousands of years.
Yes.
All right. Dr. Charles Till, hold tight. We're at the bottom of the hour. He is my guest, and he helped design, or at least get working from a physics point of view, the first reactor in the world in Canada. I'm Art Bell.
Beer cans gonna be buried in them landfills. No deposit, no sad songs of no return. Yeah, it's only going to take about a minute or so till the factories blot the sun out, and you're going to have to turn your lights on just to see. And then the lights are going to be neon, saying, fly our jets to paradise, and the whole damn world's going to be made of styrene.
Listen, well, my brothers, when you hear the night wind sigh and you see the wild goose flying through the great polluted sky, there won't be no country music, there won't be no rock and roll, because when they take away our country, they'll take away our soul.
To talk with Art Bell, call the wildcard line at area code 775-727-1295. The first-time caller line is area code 775-727-1222. To talk with Art Bell from east of the Rockies, call toll-free at 800-825-5033. From west of the Rockies, call Art at 800-618-8255. International callers may reach Art Bell by calling your in-country Sprint access number, pressing option 5, and dialing toll-free 800-893-0903. From coast to coast and worldwide on the Internet, this is Coast to Coast AM with Art Bell.
Good morning, everybody. Dr. Charles Till is my guest, and we're talking about nuclear power. He was the physicist responsible for, I guess, making sure that everything ran well in the first Canadian reactor ever to be built. So he's quite a man to talk to about where we are in the world with nuclear power. And by the way, I should tell you that I'm not anti-nuclear, exactly, nor am I pro-nuclear. I'm thoughtful on the whole matter. I understand that our nation, the world, really desperately needs a clean source of power. We desperately need it, and what looms ahead if we don't get it is horrible. I mean, what's going to happen with the price of oil and the price of energy in general is going to promote nothing but discontent, war, and death if we don't find an answer. It's a big problem facing the whole world right now, and for that matter, I don't know which side Dr. Till is on now, but I guarantee you we'll find out. By the way, with respect to the kid of speed thing, you know, the motorcycle thing, whether or not it was a hoax, there are some who say it was a hoax, doesn't change the situation on the ground at Chernobyl. It's absolutely incredible. I mean, what has happened there is, it's very sobering indeed. If you see a report on it, and I've seen various reports on the sarcophagus and the troubles they're having and what their expectations are and the heat building, and oh, God, what a nightmare, a total nightmare. At any rate, when first creating this reactor in Canada, Dr. Till, there was apparently sort of three periods involved, one of creativity. I don't know. Was the U.S. sharing?
Oh, yes.
Okay.
All right, let me just go on with that, because it's a good way to think about it. In fact, the U.S. is central, always in the early days of nuclear development. Every nation looked to the U.S., Canada, the U.K., the European nations, and in fact, if the truth were told, the Soviet Union as well through espionage. But, the point really is that for the first 20 years, there was no decision made as to what kind of reactor would be pursued as the main power generator.
Right.
There were it was a period when the physicists to begin with were sort of in charge, and they were king, because how do you in fact make the nuclear fission work with the various materials? What are the probabilities of this, that, and the other thing? It was an exciting time.
I bet.
Because it was all new, all discoveries. You'd go to the national meetings, as I did, and new discoveries, new directions. It was a marvelous time, and that lasted from it lasted basically into the mid 60s. In the mid 60s, the first in the U.S. in the first that was the first commercial reactor that was offered by a vendor at a guaranteed price that would produce electrical power at an economical, an economical price. When that happened, the second phase of nuclear development, that signaled the second phase, and that was one basically of a rush to build, particularly in the U.S. And that lasted from, let's say, 65, 66, somewhere there, to 1974. There were just tremendous numbers of these very large water reactors ordered. 1 year, the peak year, 40 of them were ordered in 1 year. And that was, if one did the calculation, roughly 10% of the whole electrical capacity of the United States at that time.
So the world was hot for it.
Very much so. The utilities wanted it.
Doctor, in retrospect, I mean, for example, right now, we're always having fights over standards, whether it's fighting over standards for high-definition television or whatever it is. We're always having these big fights over standards. In retrospect, was the whole nuclear thing done too quickly? Should there have been some world forum at which there was a standard agreed and accepted, and you know, all of it? Should that have been done?
Well, I think there's no question, or at least there's none in my mind, that in that second period of a rush to build, that all that happened far, far too quickly.
Mm-hmm.
That apart from the kind of standards that you're alluding to, which may have been a good idea, but the way I think of it is that the way you develop any technology is you build, you try, you learn, you build on the basis of that learning, and so on. You have a generation after a generation after a generation until finally you perfect.
Mm-hmm.
And there simply wasn't time for that. I think the reactors, well, I know the reactors today, at least in my view, are perfectly adequately safe. There are some 100 of them, as you may know, around the United States at the moment, producing something like 20% of the power.
Mm-hmm.
But the other electrical power. But the other thing that must be said is that at the time in the 70s when those reactors were being built, nuclear power, while convenient, perhaps, wasn't needed in the sense that you are saying, that you're describing how it may be needed in the future.
Hmm.
You know, there's plenty of oil then.
Yes.
Plenty of alternative then.
Yes. How did the price per kilowatt hour, for example, of nuclear power compare to that produced by conventional fuels?
Well, it had to compete, and it did. But that brings me to the next period, which really was from 74 onward, when there were no more orders, because the organized opposition to nuclear simply became too strong, and they the opponents were able to, through lawsuits and other stratagems, to drive the price of particularly the building of a nuclear plant high enough that no utility would gamble on it.
It was not a good economic bet any longer, huh?
Well, it wasn't because the construction was never able to proceed without being held up by suits and so on. The reactors that were built, however, were economical, produced power economically, as I say, those 100 of them, And today, of course, because the cost of the building of them has all been amortized, and it's only the operation and the cost of the fuel, which is small. I mean, they're tremendous cash generators today.
Then the lawsuits and all of that, even today, remain the reason why more are not being built. Is that fair?
The fear of that, yes. But let me also say, and it'll bring me to the central point that I feel strongly about, and that is that these reactors do not use their fuel efficiently at all. They use less than 1%, closer to 0.5% of the uranium that's actually mined from the ground.
And that results in a very great deal of a waste material, high-level
yes,
waste, is that right?
It results in what you were referring to in your hometown there.
Uh-huh.
The reactor development that it became clear to me, and I imagine others, but I was in the center of it at Argonne. I'll come to that perhaps if you like in the next while. But it came to me that there were several different characteristics that a successful reactor for the future must have, and they're very simple, very common sense. The first is that you have to have a reactor that uses its fuel efficiently enough that it's worthwhile developing it, that it's going to be the answer for the future.
Mm-hmm.
And the second one is that you better have a form of safety that doesn't rely on human operators, because we all make mistakes.
Mm-hmm.
And the third is that you better have a form of the waste product that isn't so very long-lived, and that people just instinctively rebel against the thought of, that you've created something that's a danger for an unimaginably long time.
So who has a reactor that meets all that criteria?
Well, that was the Integral Fast Reactor project at Argonne that I led. That was what we were trying to do. And we had...
Why has it not been done, then?
We had... It's really rather simple. We had for 10 years we had a very successful project. It involved developing the new fuel, developing the whole thing, the new fuel, the form of safety, and a new process that would allow the fuel to be recycled without increasing the danger of proliferation from processing. And a shorter-lived waste product. We've got a long way along all those paths.
So why isn't it currently the reactor being produced in use all over the world?
The whole thing was canceled precipitately in 1994. When the Clinton administration came in, it was announced in the State of the Union address that unnecessary programs are going to be canceled, and in particular any programs on advanced nuclear energy would be canceled. It took 2 years for them to be able to do that, because Congress, and a Democrat Congress, I might say, was supportive of the project for the reasons that you can imagine.
Yes.
But in the end, and the details of it are really kind of interesting for historical reasons. Put it this way, I have no illusions about the Integral Fast Reactor project being resurrected. That was then. The skilled people who were leading the various parts of it are now gone. The facilities that we used there to do the development now scattered, gone, shut down, and so the principal purpose of us talking about it today is the lessons that are there, and to say the kinds of things that are possible, in fact, with nuclear, that are not possible in present nuclear, and we went a long way toward showing what was possible. In the end, the politics ruled, and that was 10 years ago.
And it's remained that way ever since. Well, there have been, though, other administrations that would have been much more friendly to such a obviously important concept as a reactor that would efficiently burn, be economically feasible, and not produce waste. I mean, that's a big concept, Doctor. Why didn't, I don't know, the Reagan administration or one of the other...
Well, the Reagan, let me try to describe that as objectively as I can. The Reagan administration was pro-nuclear
yes.
Power, but not wildly so. The budgets that they provided were probably 10 or 20% of what they'd been 10 years before, and the prevailing mood in the country was still very much anti-nuclear in some senses, actually, for large technologies, anti-technology. The Reagan administration had many different fish to fry, and they were supportive enough that I was able to get this program started in 1985, which in its way was a miracle, because a very large program is needed if you're going to be successful. And to be able to get that started in the mid-80s, I've always been thankful for.
But even after it was killed, I mean, now a lot of years have gone by, Doctor, and
yep.
other administrations have come and gone, and the energy crisis is very apparent today.
Mm-hmm.
So if there is a way to have a safe, productive reactor, then why are we not doing it today?
Well, it should be done. There's no question in my mind that it should be done. And my point really was that we went far enough to show that it probably can be done.
Mm-hmm.
But when that was canceled in 94, I mean, just aside, it was canceled in September of 94. 2 months later, the Republicans swept the power in both houses, and there's no question they would have supported it to completion, which would have taken another 2 or 3 years. There were plenty of Democrats, though, that supported us in Congress, obviously, because we'd had Democrat Congresses through the 10 years of it. But then in the remaining years of the Clinton administration, and that runs us right through to the year 2000, there was no advanced reactor work being done at all. And then in the present administration, some advanced reactor studies are being done, but again, in my view, they're not well directed. So I recognize I'll get an argument with the people that support those programs.
Probably.
But my argument is an extremely simple one. Unless you can develop a form of electrical power that has essentially infinite fuel, nuclear is a very difficult technology, and it probably isn't worthwhile unless it can take a very large portion of the nation and the world's energy needs, service those needs.
Is that, you know, I feel as I listen to you that you do feel that it is possible. I mean,
it is possible. There is no question about that. But in order to, in my mind, there's no question about it. But in order to develop that, you have to have the right, I mean, if you're going to develop anything, successfully, you have to have the right goals to begin with, and then a very informed notion as to what kind of technology will meet those goals, and then the will, in fact, to push on and do it. So those none of those things are there, in my view, in the present small Department of Energy.
Well, time marches on, Doctor. We're going to break here at the top of the hour, and we're getting more desperate all the time. So.
Now that you're gone,
we'll be right back.
Needles and pins, why had you done? Watching that clock till you return. Tying that torch and watching you burn.
Bell. Call the Wildcard Line at area code 775-727-1295. The first-time caller line is area code 775-727-1222. To talk with Art Bell from east of the Rockies, call toll-free at 800-825-5033. From west of the Rockies, call 800-618-8255. International callers may reach Art by calling your in-country Sprint access number, pressing option 5. And dialing toll-free 800-893-0903. From coast to coast and worldwide on the Internet, this is Coast to Coast AM with Art Bell.
It is. My guest is Dr. Charles Till, the physicist responsible for the physics part of the first reactor built in Canada. So he's a man who knows an awful lot about atomic energy. And I have quite a number of questions for him. Stay right where you are. All right, I think it would be useful at this point to find out whether Dr. Till and I agree with regard to the world's current situation. In other words, Dr. Till, right now, we seem to be at a sort of a juncture, perhaps already at that peak oil point, or if we're not at it, then we're close to it, and we can see down the tunnel a little ways where it is. Peak oil meaning, you know, we're pumping as much as we're ever going to be pumping, and we're going to pump at that level, or it's going to begin to decline. And it seems to me that as we decline, awful things are going to begin to happen, like, the price of gasoline rising to the point that people can't go to work anymore. Wars will occur for access to what little is left, that sort of thing. That's the future that I see as a probable one. How do you read it?
I can't see any reason to think otherwise. The only question is, of course, when does that peak come?
Mm.
I think the more frightening thing, as you said, than the price of gasoline going up is the absolute certainty of warfare over the remaining resources.
If it comes to that,
unless there is an alternative, unless there are realistic alternatives.
I'm not even sure it's not happening right now. But that issue aside for a second.
Yes.
I've had for years doing this kind of program, Doctor, I've had emails, communications from people making claims that they've got some box, some technological development that they've made, that some magic black box, and you put in a little bit of power and out comes a lot of power. In other words, free energy or something very close to free energy. As a physicist, I'm sure that you've looked at a lot of these things, and I would like to tap your knowledge and just know if you are aware of anything out there that even approaches reality in this area. Is there any black box out there or technology you're aware of that'll come along and save us?
Art, I was in charge of the reactor program at Argonne. There were some 2,000 people there for, as you said, 20 years. I would guess every month for those 20 years, I had at least one, sometimes half a dozen, proposals sent to me to comment on and hopefully support for everything from perpetual motion to the kind of magic device that would take energy and without any further input of energy increase the amount of energy at the output. Various people who proposed to have by radio waves reduce the radioactivity of substance and so on. I mean, all of these just defeat the laws of physics. And just flatly the answer to your question is no, there is none.
There is none.
There is none. Look, it's energy is a big industrial commodity. It has to meet the common sense criterion. And oil today carries such a heavy load. Now, in the United States, and I imagine it's true in any developed country, the split in the way energy is used is roughly one-third, one-third, one-third. One-third goes to electricity, one-third goes to transportation, one-third goes to heating and industrial processes.
Okay.
So there is some ability to substitute back and forth across those lines. But if you're going to really make any kind of an impact on oil and gas, you have to install huge amounts of electrical capacity. Electricity will substitute for almost anything. And so that's the way to go. But there aren't alternatives. You know, wind, small amount. Solar, small amount.
Would you continue to maintain small amount even if there was a gigantic effort made and giant wind farms were placed and solar farms here in the Southwest where all of those commodities are readily available is still only a dent?
It would still only be a dent. And whether, you know, it depends on what one's idea of an attractive landscape is, but take wind for example. It's unreliable. It's unsightly. It produces only small amounts of power per unit, requiring lots and lots and lots of land. It's a hard way to go. I would certainly support any development along those lines.
Well,
one isn't going to make a dent in the requirement.
Okay. Well, that's the overall important point. However, here in the American Southwest, we have a great deal of unused BLM government land, which is not going to turn anybody's head because of the ugly wind generators or the solar panels that might be pointed toward the sky. I mean, there is a lot of farming that could be done out here, and I'm sure you support at least that being done, don't you?
Of course I do.
Mm-hmm. All right.
Or any other realistic alternative. You know, and the people talk about the tides and this and the other thing. But one thing one must keep in mind, in any of this, as an engineer, in order to produce large amounts of energy, you have to have a source of energy that is fairly, where the original energy from the sun has been gathered. And that's in coal, for example, and oil and gas, in the fossil things. It's gathered there, it's concentrated. The engineer can get it released in large amounts,
mm-hmm,
with fairly simple processes. With nuclear, it's even more concentrated.
Let's go back to that for 1 second. As I mentioned to you, I live in Pahrump, Nevada now.
Mm-hmm.
If you, it's great to wish that your project had gotten off the ground. We'd built many of those reactors,
sure,
but it didn't happen.
Sure.
And we are faced today with a reality because of the kind of reactors that we have in this country. And that reality is all of this waste material, high-level waste material that I understand tens of thousands of years will pass and we'll have to store it safely in Yucca Mountain or wherever it is we end up putting it. If you were the man in charge here in the U.S. of the problem of nuclear waste, what would you do? Assuming you had, you could just issue an edict as a physicist and say, here's what we're going to do, what would you do?
If I had the power to do that, I suppose I would have the funds in order to implement it.
That's
look,
right, yes.
The suspension in the 70s of reprocessing was part of the effort to close down nuclear power. Reprocessing would have given a waste form that mm-hmm would have been much more compact, much easier, and if the reprocessing was done properly, to have a lower lived waste. And more than that, you wouldn't be burying a material that 99 point, well, in the material you're burying, it's more like 96% of it is still perfectly useful for energy.
What would have, could have, that's done. And
right, what would I do now?
That's the question.
There isn't, in the present circumstance, there isn't any alternative. If you're going to have the nuclear power and you're not going to have processing, there is no alternative but to bury it in Yucca Mountain or somewhere else. It can't stay in the storage pools around the reactors forever. So, so the, you know, like many other things in our lives, the decisions made 30 years ago,
yes,
we're paying for.
Yes. How long will we have to be careful stewards of that material once we get it buried wherever it's going?
Well, the long-lived elements in there are the so-called man-made elements, not the fission products. And the long-lived ones, and the reason that one's concerned about them principally is that in addition to being very long-lived, they can, if the water drainage is suitable to it, you can contaminate water supplies in some distant time.
Mm-hmm. How long, doctor?
Hundreds of thousands of years. Basically.
Hundreds of thousands of years?
Yeah. These things are very long-lived.
What I was going to ask
is... My point is that they should not really be buried.
Yeah,
I
got that, but you also said we have no choice.
Well, there's no such program, and there's no prospect of a program.
All right, doctor, I once saw a Good Morning America, and they had this most remarkable demonstration on. I'm sure you probably heard about it. And they took some high-level waste, or a little tiny bit of it, and they, in the period of 15 or 20 minutes, did some process and reduced, you know, what normally would have a half-life of, as you just mentioned, longer than we can imagine. It just knocked down the radiation, apparently, so quickly. It was on Good Morning America. Did you ever hear about that?
I never saw that, no? And I can't fathom what would have been done.
I've always wondered, because I never heard anything after that demonstration that I thought was incredible. So,
yeah, well, it is incredible. it isn't possible in the way we're thinking about it.
Mm-hmm. So, in other words, again,
the thing you could do, of course, is have a simple process, as we did with our IFR reactor,
uh-huh.
to separate the long-lived ones from the shorter-lived ones, and just. And just deal then with the shorter lived ones in a repository that you would have every confidence that would last the few tens or hundreds of years that would be required before they decayed away to levels similar to the original uranium.
Well, man has never done anything for hundreds of thousands of years.
No, of course not. Hundreds of years, yes, churches, all kinds of things, but of course.
Yes, hundreds of thousands of years.
Of course, I mean, it's unimaginable, isn't it?
Yes. Yes, actually, totally unimaginable.
Yeah.
And if there's not an earthquake now, there will be one later.
Yeah.
And if there's not some other form of tragedy now, there will be one later. There could be a rock from space that would... I mean, if all of this stuff that they're going to stuff in the ground, Doctor, got exposed... either into a water table or got exposed to the air by accident, what would the likely results be?
Well, the result would be one that you would it would vary. Look, I've worked with a lot of radioactivity over the years, and when the let's talk about spent fuel. When the spent fuel first comes out of the reactor, it's very hot indeed, very radioactive. You don't want to be standing by it.
Mm-hmm.
But it doesn't take very many weeks before most of that dies away. The very long-lived material is not very radioactive. In other words, in order for it to harm a human, I mean, you can stand by it. In fact, you can pick it up in your hands. I've done that in experiments. The very long life stuff has to be ingested as you would ingest arsenic or something else, heavy metal like that would harm you.
You see, that's why I was asking about water tables.
Yeah, and that is exactly right. It would have to be in the water or the air, and you'd have to ingest it either in your lungs or whatever. Very similar to any other heavy metal. Ingesting radium, ingesting, and so on. But as far as the danger in standing by it is concerned, that's confined to the first, I don't know, 100, 200, 300 years, something like that.
I see.
Which I don't think is generally appreciated. I'm not sure how important that is.
Well, it's fairly important to me.
Yeah.
Actually.
Because that's what we tried to do with the IFR. And each of the things I mentioned, but let me stay to the waste. The waste, we wanted to have simply fission product. Simply the fission product. And what that meant was, as I said, in perhaps 300 years, or depending on one or two things, but in a few hundred years, 300, 500, 200, whatever, that the activity would have dropped to the same level as the original uranium when it was mined, which was just a criterion we used to say, well, that's pretty good.
That's pretty good.
Yeah.
Can IFR be restarted? Can it? I mean, today, for example, could that whole process begin and we could start building reactors?
We are, the short answer is no. The longer answer, the short answer is no because, as I said, the facilities, the people have been scattered to the winds, since.
But ideas.
You can say there are other people, other facilities.
But ideas don't die.
Ideas don't die.
People
no.
move, people
will this,
die.
Will this kind of technology eventually be adopted? I don't think there's any doubt about it. But will it be done in this country? Not under the present environment. Let me talk about the safety for a second, just because we were talking a lot about Chernobyl. In the test reactor, the IFR test reactor that we operate here in Idaho, we carried out the same accident that about 2 or 3 weeks later happened at Chernobyl in our test reactor to show that it would shut itself down without humans doing anything or...
That'd be loss of coolant.
It was loss of coolant. It was shutting off the coolant pumps.
Just shutting them off.
Just shutting them off and letting the and no control rods going in, nothing. Just
and,
letting
and
the materials that the reactor was made of.
And in the IFR test reactor, what happened?
Nothing. It just shut itself down. And in the afternoon, we started the reactor up again. And if you recall the Three Mile Island accident, what happened there was that the heat from the reactor was unable to be transferred to the electrical system, and so the reactor just heated itself up. We did exactly the same thing in the IFR test that afternoon. Once again, the reactor just shut itself down. And we were sure it would by gradually working up to that and by calculation. But it was a remarkable demonstration. Those were the two accidents. One had happened before, one happened after. We did those tests. It was kind of interesting. There was a science reporter in the Wall Street Journal, Bishop, Jerry Bishop, who had the experience going back to the early days of nuclear. And the kind of press release that the Department of Energy put out, which was kind of opaque, Jerry was smart enough to realize what this was when Chernobyl happened. He realized that this was exactly the same as the Chernobyl thing that we had done in Idaho about two weeks before.
All right, Doctor, hold it right there. We're
sure.
Here at the bottom of the hour. Dr. Charles Till is my guest, and I know to a lot of you, nuclear energy is sort of magic, and you don't understand it. This will be your night to be able to ask questions of somebody who does know the real story.
At area code 775-727-1295. The first-time caller line is area code 775-727-1222. To talk with Art Bell from East of the Rockies, call toll-free at 800-825-5033. From West of the Rockies, call Art at 800-618-8255. International callers may reach Art Bell by calling your in-country Sprint access number, pressing option 5. And dialing toll-free 800-893-0903. from coast to coast and worldwide on the internet. This is Coast to Coast AM with Art Bell.
It is. My guest is Dr. Charles Till, who did the physics part of the first Canadian reactor, nuclear reactor. And nuclear power is one of those things that I think the average person has a fear of, an instilled fear of, possibly for some good reason, I might add, but doesn't understand very well. So this is your opportunity to ask anything you've always wanted to know about nuclear power. And so we're going to open the phones in a moment. Stay right where you are. All right, once again, Dr. Charles Till. Dr. Till, two, as I mentioned there, most Americans have sort of a vague fear, or maybe not so vague, of nuclear power, with some good cause, bearing in mind what's happened in the world with it. Although I understand that on the safety side of it, people can cite statistics of the number of kilowatt hours produced and all the rest of it. And we've only had one major accident and a few minor ones. But nevertheless, they have a kind of a fear of nuclear energy and don't understand a lot about it. So I'd like to be able to let them ask some questions. Ross of Minneapolis, Minnesota, has a real good one that he blasted to me on the computer here. He says, ask the doctor, please, about fusion power and where we are with fusion now. I've sort of vaguely heard things about it in the experimentation going on. What would fusion be as compared to what we have now?
Well, first of all, there is the principal difference in my mind between fusion and fission reactors is that we know how to build the fission reactors. The fusion work is still in the R&D stage.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not skeptical about eventually being able to make fusion work, although magnetic fusion does require a very large facility with the knowledge we have today, and I doubt very much if the power would be close to economic. Fusion is not as clean as people, clean of radioactivity as people might think just offhand. The material that the fuel material is tritium, which is an interestingly radioactive material itself, and the all of the materials of construction get pretty heavily irradiated. So there is some element of waste to consider there too, not on the scale, of course, of fission. Mm-hmm. So I guess to summarize, where I think it is that it hasn't been proven. It isn't something that you could point to rely on, but work most certainly should continue on it.
Mm-hmm. All right, let's take some questions from the audience. First time caller line, you're on the air with Dr. Till. Hi.
Hi, how are you?
Fine. What is your first name?
My name's Chris.
Okay, Chris, what's up?
Yeah, I had two questions, and I hope I got the right name right. In the 1920s, there was a big experience done. I think it was Marconi. I'm not sure if I got the right name, but he built a huge energy source.
Okay, I think you mean Tesla.
Tesla, right. And he did this huge energy experience, but he couldn't control it, so he was shut down. And I was going to ask about that, and then also I was going to ask about what he thought about hydrogen power.
All right, let's take both questions. Thank you very much. First of all, Tesla, doctor, there's all kinds of rumors and lore about what Tesla did and did not
do. Have you ever looked into the life of Tesla?
No, I haven't. I think a little bit the way you describe it. It sounds like it's interesting, but it's kind of puzzling. I can answer the first part of it very honestly and very directly, and that is that I know so little about it that any comment I might make would be perfectly would not be useful.
Good answer.
The second part of it,
hydrogen.
Hydrogen, I think, is more straightforward. Something that, again, I'm not an expert on, but I, you know, people that.
All right. Well, the Bush administration has pretty much forwarded the concept of hydrogen as the rather immediate answer to our problems. They're proceeding along a hydrogen path. Good idea or not?
Well, it's a good idea, but for the immediate future, no. Look, the problems with hydrogen are fairly simple.
And they are?
They are that it's difficult to store. The first thing that you worry about with hydrogen, of course, is getting some oxygen there and getting a very loud bang. But as an engineering matter, it takes energy to make hydrogen. The reason that you'd make hydrogen is to use it in for transportation. Of course, you don't gain energy by.
Okay, that was the important question, and that's what I've heard others say, that mm-hmm. That you have to use energy to create and then to store the
right.
hydrogen,
right.
And so it's not like a net gain, it's not like the sort of free thing, or
no,
free is a bad word, but even close to free thing, that or a replacement thing.
Right. Well, look at it this way: hydrogen is made from water, and the way the hydrogen is burned, it makes water back again. So it's clean, and I mean clean burning in the sense that the combustion product is water, but you haven't had to expend energy to split the water to begin with into hydrogen, and then of course you use it, as I said, to produce the energy, and so the purpose of it is to make your electrical energy portable.
Mm-hmm. All right, let me throw another big barb at you and see how you do with it. Well, what we have been doing and are doing now is expending fossil fuels. In the process of expending fossil fuels, a great deal is ejected into the atmosphere by the cars we drive and the factories we run. And there are many who now feel that what's been ejected into the atmosphere is beginning to affect our Earth in terms of warming it and melting the North Pole and the South Pole and affecting our climate. Do you have any thoughts on that?
Well, yes. In the job I had all kinds of presentations of things, and the early studies on global warming by CO2. I had presentations made there, both at the laboratory and the university, by the scientists that were doing it. I studied their papers. What there is no question about in my mind is, and the evidence is absolutely clear: the carbon dioxide component of the atmosphere is going up steadily year by year.
Yes.
What isn't as obvious is whether that really is having any effect on the temperatures around the world. Every climate environmentalist will say, well, we've had a half a degree in the last 50 years or something like that, and which is, although those measurements are difficult to make, I accept them. On the other hand, in the previous 50 years, there was probably half a degree of cooling. So it isn't, in my view, as absolutely clear as the way it's being used in the political situation, particularly internationally. It is not clear in my mind. On the other hand, there are other things that are, acid rain and so on and so on.
Yes.
Those things just have to be taken care of.
Yes. What does seem clear, though, is that about 40% of the polar ice has gone in the last 50 years, you mentioned, and... down south, we're getting a lot of calving. The Ross Ice Field may or may not be stable. There are indications now that it may not be as stable as they thought it was. And, of course, that would be serious trouble because that ice is all on land. Should it melt or slide, why, the ocean levels would get very unacceptably high with not good results.
No, of course not. And the question is whether that's man-made.
Yes, that is. What's your feeling?
Well, I feel that the models, having looked at the papers, the computer models that they use are very sensitive to their assumptions, and I would find it hard to really accept the results. My own, you know, reading about this over the last several centuries, as you know from your very informed comment there, that there are large swings in the average temperature over the year simply due to the, you know, the effects of sun and
mm-hmm.
sunspots and so on, ice ages, little ice ages, and so on. And whether the current tendency toward warming is man-made, that is, the link has not been shown to me, in my mind.
Well, I wonder if they'll discover and affirm that link any faster than they did the link between cancer and tobacco.
Well, of course, you make a good point. We
stumbled over that one for a long time.
when it was an absolutely direct link, in fact.
Well, I do recall the cigarette CEOs sitting in front of a congressional or Senate inquiry saying, no, it's not addictive.
Right.
No, it's not addictive.
Right. But by the mid-70s, it was clear it was not just a statistical, it was a direct link.
Mm-hmm.
In the case of carbon dioxide, I don't think you could make that case yet myself. And I'm saying that as one who, supports the use of nuclear power as broadly as is possible, and clearly using the thought that carbon dioxide in the air is going to be harmful to the climate makes the case for nuclear.
Mm-hmm. That's right. Wild Card Line, you're on the air with Dr. Charles Till. Good morning.
Yes, good morning, Art. This is Ahab listening on the Big 89 out of Chicago, South Bend. Well, Dr. Till, and first off, I just want to say I still have a big smile on my face. Thanks for the feedback on Ann, because, you know, you put those prayers out there, and, you know, sometimes you wonder what happens, you know?
Well, there you are, sir.
So I'm still smiling about that. I'm glad to hear the good news.
Good.
And, Doctor, I got to say, thank you for all the good work that you tried to do and in enlightening people about the truth about nuclear industry. I mean, most people don't understand the history of the marketplace and what happened and how, you know, with the oil crisis kind of fueled that rush to market, you know, with the second and third generation designs that really became like the industry standard when they never should have been. And it's kind of soured everybody on the entire industry. And, I mean, if to the, you know, and I honest to God, I am maybe a terminal optimist, but I think that the work that you guys did, it will come to light sooner or later. You know, they're going to have to mothball. These things are all going to run their, you know, life cycle. And sooner or later, we can't just write off 20% of our electrical generating power capacity. They're going to have to, you know, go back and reexamine the work you did. It will come back to light.
Mm-hmm.
It's just a matter of time, and thank you for that.
Well, I appreciate that.
But my big question, I guess, for you is, I know coming from your background, you're thinking like big centralized production. But when you look at the alternatives and maybe the other uses of nuclear energy, don't you think that the real answers are all in decentralized power production?
Well, I recognize the argument there, but the thing that one always fights against, of course, is that you do get tremendous economies of scale, as you well know.
Right, and, right. But for a certain percentage of that we need to generate, we do need those economies of scale just because of the way we live and organize our society.
Mm-hmm, but, precisely so.
But for the vast other sections of the energy that we use for heating and transportation, we don't need that centralized power.
Right?
Right. I mean, that's by its nature, the way we use it in our homes and in our vehicles and in transportation is all decentralized. And I can only, I guess in my mind, I think of all the brain power and all the huge financial resources that have been kind of thrown at the energy market in all sectors, and if just a fraction have even went into what, you know, into oil exploration or nuclear, you know, research, had gone into somehow figuring out how to make use of that big bad nuclear reactor in the sky, you know, that's perfectly decentralized, utterly predictable. It's a very safe standoff distance.
All right, well,
and very diffuse, unfortunately.
Yes.
If you can stand outside, you know, the way I explained it to my kids was that if you can stand outside and turn your palm up to the sky and simply feel the heat of the sun, that means that you're going to have a considerable amount of effort gathering up enough of that heat to really be useful. Clearly, you can heat homes, particularly in the south. Clearly, you can dry grain. All of these things. Clearly, you can produce some electricity, but it's a difficult business.
Dr. Till, let me take a leap forward in this area. The sun, sure, it all comes one way or the other from the sun, and as you point out, it's concentrated in the fossil fuels. But there is this new idea that people are churning around that, in combination with nanotechnology, a gathering place in space, in orbit, could be achieved, and power could be collected very efficiently in a geosynchronous sort of orbit, I guess, and then transferred to Earth stations by satellite. What do you have you looked at that at all?
No, I haven't. I've had those kinds of suggestions made, of course. The sort of common sense reaction that I generally have is, well and good collecting it there. How are you proposing to get huge amounts of power down to the Earth's surface?
Microwave.
If you're going to do that way, I wouldn't want to stand in front of the beam.
No, wouldn't be advised.
Wouldn't be advised.
But
these things may be possible. I don't really know.
Okay. Mm-hmm. Again, fair enough. East of the Rockies, you're on the air with Dr. Till. Hello.
Good evening, or should I say good morning, Dr. Till, and good morning, Art.
Good morning, sir. You're not too strong. You're going to have to yell at us a little.
No problem. This is Greg from WABC in New York.
Yes, sir.
And my question is about the use of nuclear power with military vehicles, in particular nuclear-powered aircraft carriers. The world's first aircraft carrier, nuclear-powered aircraft carrier, the USS Enterprise, is due for decommission in 2013. Does Dr. Till have any idea as to some best practices to decommission a carrier that's as big as the Empire State Building and has 8 reactors?
Yeah, interesting question.
It is an interesting question, my short answer is no. That's not anything that I've ever looked at, and I want to try to be a little bit careful about what I know and saying what I know and what I don't know.
Okay.
But no, I'm sorry. I just don't know.
Do you, in your professional opinion, how do you feel about the use of reactors at sea going into war?
There's an awfully good question, Doctor.
Well, we have a very considerable submarine fleet, as you well know.
Nuclear powered, yes.
Submarine fleet. I suppose the question is directed at, well, all right, but what happens if these surface vessels or submarine vessels are attacked and destroyed?
I'll tell you what, Doctor. Hold that thought. But reactors going into battle is a very, very interesting question. My guest is Dr. Charles Till, and we'll jump right on that one when we get back. I'm Mark Bell.
talk with Art Bell, call the Wildcard line at area code 775-727-1295. The first-time caller line is area code 775-727-1222. To talk with Art Bell from east of the Rockies, call toll-free at 800-825-5033. From west of the Rockies, call 800-618-8255. International callers may reach Art by calling your in-country Sprint access number, pressing option 5, and dialing toll-free 800-893-0903. From coast to coast and worldwide on the Internet, this is Coast to Coast AM with Art Bell.
It is, and my guest, Dr. Charles Till. He's got a website, by the way, and we've got a link up there. It's a long URL, so go to coasttocoastam.com and follow the link if you wish to know more. In a moment, we're going to ask about reactors going to war. Reactors and aircraft carriers, reactors and submarines, lots and lots of reactors going to war where they could get, well, blown up, right? We'll be right back. By the way, quick note for the audience, tomorrow night begins a unique process that we do once a year in which we allow the audience, particularly the talented members of the audience, to make a prediction for the year upcoming, in this case 2005. Now, I have the list, the carefully protected list of numbered predictions. It's the only time of the year we allow this, and we actually number the predictions as you make them, and I'm asking that my audience, as I did last year, with good effect, I might add, actually not just dial and call, but take a moment between now and tomorrow night, and then again on the 31st, I'm going to be off for the Christmas holiday. So we'll have two nights. That would be tomorrow night and the 31st for you to register your predictions. Don't do it lightly. Think very carefully about it. And if you have a talent for seeing the future, then use it between now and when you make your prediction. At any rate, we'll be up to that tomorrow night. Now, once again, Dr. Charles Till, and the question was with respect to reactors and going to war. Certainly in a war situation, it would be possible that a reactor on a nuclear sub or an aircraft carrier or wherever we use them in the military these days could be itself blown up. And so the obvious question on behalf of those who live in the world would be, what effect would there be, likely?
Well, and the answer, I'm sure, varies with whose nuclear navy we're talking about. Look, the nuclear navy, our own nuclear navy, is almost a nation to itself. There's And what the designs are of the reactors, how much shielding they have, and so on, and so on. All of that is classified, and it isn't anything I've ever made a study of. The advantage, obviously, of using nuclear is that you can go literally years without going back to port for refueling.
Yes.
The obvious question that the listener asks, I don't know the answer to. I would hope that they're extremely well shielded, but I simply don't know.
Yes,
the designs are not published.
Yes, well, even that in mind, Doctor, take a nuclear submarine as an example. As well shielded as it may be, a nuclear submarine could, in a war, encounter a nuclear detonation close by, and close by enough to virtually vaporize the nuclear submarine, and so the question is, what environmental effect would we possibly realize should that opening occur?
Sure. My own guess is that the nuclear explosion that caused the submarine to it would probably be the very much larger effect of the two. But
okay.
But
it would add.
You would add some. I suppose some small amount to it. What has happened with the Russian nuclear submarines, there's one or two, as you know, have been lost, so-called.
Yes, yes.
And there are a lot of them in port that need the reactors removed, and those things are going on, again, with U.S. help. But that whole subject of the nuclear navy, the use of reactors, is not one that I specialized in at all.
And it's all classified.
And it's classified
okay.
up and down the line, even the core designs are.
All right. Well, here's a good question for you. You're certainly familiar with when we and others built reactors early on.
Mm-hmm.
I think the psychology at that time was, let's see if we can build a reactor that's economically feasible and safe.
Correct.
Now, when we were thinking about safe in those days, I don't think we were thinking a whole lot about a guy with a shoulder-fired, armor-piercing missile in his hand shooting at one of the containments. But today, we are thinking about that. Because we have no shortage of people apparently willing to give their lives in an effort to kill lots of us. So if a person had a shoulder-fired, armor-piercing missile and was firing at a containment, what would the probable outcome be? Or would it bounce off the containment?
I don't know. I can tell you that that in addition to the containment, once you're inside the containment, you're looking at least 7 feet of reinforced concrete between that and the reactor core, at least 7 feet.
7 feet.
Of it, yeah. That's just there for shielding purposes, but it is also an extremely strong structure.
Something that could, for example, withstand a 747.
Well, yes. The thing that you would worry about there is the engines. But again, the studies that were done while I was still reasonably active said that the shielding
would hold up.
Withstand
the well, that may be the answer then. You know, when 9/11 occurred, Doctor, it was said that the terrorists actually flew over a couple of nuclear power plants to get planes down to New York and to the Pentagon. And that may be the answer to why they didn't do what people wondered why they didn't do. In other words, they knew they could not have done it.
Well, I think I think they're far better off for the effect that they're wanting to achieve. Hitting it's not a very pleasant thing to say, but hitting the large buildings, they're a big target. One thing, and secondly, they're certainly not protected like the cores of nuclear reactors.
Okay, get good and close to the phone. It's getting a little tough to hear you.
Yeah, okay,
that's good. That's much.
There was one additional point that I wanted to make on the IFR on the waste part of it.
Yes,
and that is in addition to separating the usable material from the inert material that makes up the bulk of the stuff that's going into Yucca. In addition to that, you want to be able to, of course, get rid of the long-life stuff. So you want a kind of reactor that will burn that up.
Right.
And that, again, is the kind of reactor that we were designing. It would use the americium, the neptunium, and curium equally well to plutonium or uranium-235, produce power, and be gone.
Well, you see, Doctor, I'm not a physicist, and I sit here and I listen to you, and you tell me about IFR, and you virtually are telling me this is the answer, you know, to our problems, and you really haven't offered me anything yet in terms of a reason why it's not being used right now, except stupidity. So is there any?
No, but I would put it very directly. The IFR, while in those 10 years, while we were still at a point where it was not at all clear that we could achieve the kinds of things we were talking about, was not attacked by the organized anti-nuclear people.
Another point.
When we got close enough, then the attack really started.
I see.
And when the you know, with the best will in the world, when the Clinton administration came in, it brought in a lot of very anti-nuclear folks whose life had been devoted to,
yes,
to fighting it. And the IFR obviously is aimed at a long-term nuclear energy source, and that's exactly what they did not want. And so, you know, it's a case of saying, well, what was wrong with the technology?
All right, well, I was about to ask that. What did the anti-nuclear people say was the hole in IFR?
The principal argument was similar to the argument on reprocessing, and that is to say that it would add to the proliferation risk. My response is perfectly straightforward, and that is that none of the IFR processes would allow you to even approach pure enough plutonium to, with any facility, make any kind of a nuclear weapon. That's not the way any fledgling nation, any terrorist group or anything would go. They would go the way that it is guessed that Iran is trying to go, and that is through the enrichment of uranium process, because those bombs are fairly easy to make. But to try to make a bomb out of material that is composed of all the isotopes of plutonium, plus curium, plus neptunium, plus americium, one of our very sophisticated national laboratories in this country might be able to do it. But that's the kind of expertise that it would be required.
You've mentioned Iran a number of times. Is it your... Iran is saying very strongly that why they don't want a bomb, and what they're doing is not not headed in that direction. Are they lying?
What would you guess?
The
point is that for a country that's sitting on a large fraction of the oil reserves in the world, why would you want a nuclear power plant? And in particular, why would you want a nuclear power plant that has along with it the enrichment processes that would be required if you were to fuel the plant yourself, but would also allow you to take the enrichments up to where they would be weapons usable? To me, the only reason that a nation that oil rich would be looking at that would be if they have that at least in the back of their minds.
Mm-hmm. That would have been my guess.
Sure.
Wildcard line, you're on the air with Dr. Till. Hello.
Hey, I'm just wondering, a quick history of plutonium. How was it discovered? Is it natural? Is it engineered?
Plutonium.
Plutonium?
Yeah.
Oh, yes, that's an easy one. Plutonium is a man-made, in the sense that it's made in reactors by simply uranium absorbing a neutron and not fissioning it. After a short time, that product decays to plutonium, and that's what you've got. The main isotope of plutonium has a half-life of about 25,000 years. The material itself looks like a metal like any other. I've, as I said to people lots of times, picked up over the years tons of it in gloved hands. It's not the main isotope. It's not particularly radioactive, particularly dangerous. It's it's comparable maybe to radium.
Mm-hmm.
And its chemical toxicity is it's like any other heavy metal, lead or arsenic or anything else. It's got chemical toxicity, but once you've made this stuff, it's not much different than any other heavy metal, as far as its appearance and properties are concerned.
Mm-hmm. How concerned are you about proliferation?
Oh, very. Absolutely. I mean, how could one not be?
Yes. North Korea, it is said now, may have as many as 3 bombs or more and be producing more.
Conceivable, sure.
Yes. Uh-huh. East of the Rockies, you're on the air with Dr. Till. Good morning.
Hello.
Hello.
Hi, I'm calling from Toronto, Canada.
Yes, sir.
And I'd like to say that my family feel very comfortable. Like I grew up out in Rouge Hill, and there's a couple of plants out there. And you know, the real estate value for an average starter home is like $320,000.
Right.
We used to yacht out and swim, and you know, feeling very confident because like they're fortresses and they're very secure environments.
Right.
Planes are, a plane could crash into it. It's got all kinds of shutdown systems, and it has cooling systems,
right,
and
right.
Everyone's confident. I mean, I think that in a free world, in a democratic society, right, that, you know, we have no problem, or at least people that we can have faith in, right, to be able to govern such a...
Good, I agree with you.
Such a, you know... an advancement in science, but you know we are concerned, and you know as Canadians, right, we certainly wouldn't be involved or engage with anyone that's questionable. And you know, I'm a proven, you know, like I swam in that water, and you know, as they say, you know, like it's a vibrant, like we camp out there.
Of course.
And you know, we're very confident, and we're, you know, and my old aunt was chemical buyer for one of the uranium mines, and she told me that she was very confident herself, right? So, you know, we're calm, and, you know, like our family has tons of real estate, and, you know, we're confident investing in those areas. And
well, caller, you know, I'd like to say that I'm confident, but I'm admitting that I don't know enough about it to be confident. In other words, even scientifically, I'm not aware of enough of it to feel confident. And I think a lot of Americans and Canadians share that point of view simply because they don't understand the process itself. And frankly, they've seen some mistakes made. And that has a way of undermining the confidence of people when they see a mistake made. Doctor, how do you react to that?
Well, I react, I suppose, this way. I agree very much with the Canadian caller. I wouldn't mind living, you know, the rest of my lifetime or all of my lifetime right beside either a Canadian or American or any Western nation nuclear plant. The accident, the sole accident that we've had in the kind of water reactors, either heavy or light water reactors, is the Three Mile Island accident. And
right.
It's never been proven to my satisfaction that anyone was harmed from that.
Well, all right, then here's a counter argument to some of that. And it comes from Don in Glendale, who says, why is the nuclear industry so damn secretive? Why don't they tell us the truth? Why hide meltdowns like the one, his words now, in 1958 in the mountains between Simi Valley and San Fernando Valley in Los Angeles? It was a total meltdown of a reactor. I don't know if that's true or not. I have no way of knowing. But the nuclear industry is somewhat secretive, Dr. Till, and that's another thing that sort of undermines some of the confidence.
Well, I think that's a very justified criticism for the earlier days. I mean, I would make very much the same criticism for, I'm unfamiliar with the particular reactor that he's talking about. It might have been the sodium graphite reactor. But there were so many reactors built in that period that was the research and development period, the first 20 years. All different kinds. Try this out, try that out. And when one talks about, melting the core of one of those small reactors, it's far, far different than, of course, an accident to a Three Mile Island or a Chernobyl size. There were, in those early days, there were many melting, not meltdowns particularly, but melting of fuel in test reactors. There were some test reactors that were built expressly for that purpose. in to test to see what would happen. How bad it was.
You do agree the industry is awfully secretive.
Well, I wouldn't agree with it today, but I do agree with it very much. Like in Idaho here, there was a reactor in 1960, SL1 it was called.
Hold the thought on SL1.
Sure.
We're at the bottom of the hour, and we'll be right back.
Call the Wildcard Line at area code 775-727-1295. The first-time caller line is area code 775-727-1222. To talk with Art Bell from East of the Rockies, call toll-free at 800-825-5033. From West of the Rockies, call Art at 800-618-8255. International callers may reach Art Bell by calling your in-country Sprint access number, pressing option 5, and dialing toll-free 800-893-0903. From coast to coast and worldwide on the Internet, this is Coast to Coast AM with Art Bell.
Sure does seem like we are our own worst enemies sometimes, doesn't it? If IFR really would work, if this plan that he's talking about really would work, IFR, and it's safe, and it doesn't produce byproduct and all the rest of that, and we're not doing it just because of politics and lawsuits and anti-nuclear people, then we're idiots. But then again, perhaps we are. I mean, we really are at times our own worst enemy, aren't we? More for Dr. Till in a moment. Stay right there. And once again, Dr. Charles Till, and you were beginning to tell us about a reactor, I think, close to you?
Yeah, it was in Idaho in 1960. It was, in fact, happened just after I got back from England, and I was in Canada. It was announced by the Atomic Energy Commission that there had been a chemical explosion on the reactor site out here. For reasons that I still feel puzzled about, because what it was a small army reactor that had exploded, killed four of the four workers at night. There was some evidence that, in fact, that two workers were deadly enemies and one had used it as a method of, in essence, a murder-suicide. But
I see.
But it. But the puzzling thing was, why on earth not just say what it was?
Well, I don't
know.
You know, an interesting.
But today, Art, it's different. I mean, you can. Anybody that has access and every library probably has them. The Nuclear Regulatory Commission reports. You can get every detail of the operation of present day reactors, and that's been true for some. Oh, 20, 25 years, probably.
I see, yes. Well, I'm going to be 60 years old this coming June, and I lived in a place called Blue Ridge Summit, Pennsylvania.
Mm-hmm.
That's right on the Pennsylvania-Maryland border.
Mm-hmm.
And by golly, that's where I was when Three Mile Island happened.
Mm-hmm.
And, of course, we were all totally freaked out.
Sure.
But I can tell you this, Doctor. The radio and television stations that were relaying information to us, those of us who were near the plant or even relatively near the plant,
mm-hmm.
were lying.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, my goodness, were they lying.
Mm-hmm.
So the official word was an absolute lie. I mean, there was no significant problem. It was very minor, nothing to worry about. They were lying.
Yes.
See, that's what contributes to this, you know, this...
There's two comments. Yes, I agree with you, and I'm in total sympathy with what you said, because I watched it on television, too, just like you did.
Well, there
without,
you are.
Without the fear. Because I guess I wasn't close to it. But the first thing to be said is that they weren't sure. They didn't know what happened.
Mm.
And there's no excuse for that. They did not have the level of technical scientific knowledge present in that plant, and that's freely admitted today.
Hmm.
And I can remember also just reading the minutes of the Nuclear Regulatory Commission meeting on that, and there was one of the commissioners who was technical, who was in fact the lead commissioner, and the others were, lawyers, whatever they were, and one of them said, "Tell us what's happening, Joe."
Yes.
You know, the point is that it's a point I'm making earlier. And that is that I believe nuclear is absolutely as safe as any large power source can be, if it's properly operated, properly designed, properly operated. But it's got to be operated with discernment.
But what you just told us is that it wasn't properly.
That is correct.
Operated.
That is correct.
Mm, so that makes it a pretty big if. Or was that then, and this is now, and then it wasn't, and now it is?
Yes is the answer. Now is much different. Now the plants are, generally speaking, operated by companies who have made it their business to operate them properly, with a strong regulatory commission overlooking them, and so on. I have no... I have no fear of that kind of that low technical judgment being exercised in our plants or Canadian plants or
gotcha.
You know, Western Europe.
All right. First time caller line, you're on the air with Dr. Till. Hi.
Good afternoon, Art, or good morning or something like that. First time caller, long time listener.
Yes, sir.
Good afternoon, Dr. Till.
Good afternoon.
Good evening, something like that. My question, Dr. Till, is concerning recently with the media. They have had reports of, you know, these, there's been concern about dirty bombs, and they did a report from Petersburg how easy it is to obtain nuclear materials. Has anybody approached you about this, and how much of a threat is it to the general public?
Okay, it's
well,
a good question.
Generally speaking, what they're talking about when they're talking about dirty bombs, I think, is the use of medical, an explosive with medical isotopes that they've gathered up and used that to...
or worse.
...to fear. But you can't, getting back to Art's point earlier, what would happen to you if you stood next to a spent fuel element? A spent fuel element would be a very poor choice. It would very likely, very likely kill the person who's trying to deliver the bomb, as opposed to scattering it about.
Yeah, they have lots of disposable people for that. They prove that on a daily basis.
Well,
and I think
he wouldn't be able to drive the truck, I suppose. I don't know. I really don't know. I don't take the dirty bomb scenario. I think there are much, much better ways of...
No doubt. I think the main point of a dirty bomb is psychological, not real. And it would work. I mean, there would be...
Oh, there'd be some, depending on what you have for your radioactive material.
Because of what we're talking about this morning, since people don't understand what you understand about the nature of radioactive material, mm-hmm. they would just hear bomb, and they'd hear nuclear, and that'd be that. There'd be absolute panic, and that's yeah. exactly what they'd be doing it for. Wildcard Line, you're on the air with Dr. Till. Hello.
Good morning. I have a question about disposing of the nuclear waste. I don't know if it's feasible or not, and by no means am I a litter bug, but would it be feasible to, like, put it on the moon or launch it to the sun?
The sun, yes. This is my favorite question, Dr. Till. People like this gentleman who think that perhaps it might be all right to load it all on a rocket and launch it into the sun, or perhaps in onto the moon, or,
yeah.
or whatever.
You hear that from time to time,
you
don't
do.
You? But
yes.
But if it's not safe to bury in a mountain, why would it be safe to put on a rocket?
And occasionally, rockets seem to blow up.
That's what I mean.
Yeah,
I
so
mean,
that
if,
might.
If you're not safe.
Then you'd really have it. I mean, you'd have this real high level waste, and you'd be launching it, and it
would
get
would
up
have,
into the
you
atmosphere.
You would have a classic dirty bomb, I think.
Yeah, you'd have.
No, I don't think it's a.
Bad idea.
An idea that should
okay,
be.
Okay, got it. East of the Rockies, you're on there with Dr. Till. Hello.
Hello, Art. This is Bob in Houston again.
Hello, Bob.
Hi. I was curious about, I've heard about nuclear powered lasers, especially satellite based lasers.
Oh, yes.
And also satellite nuclear power plants, if you can explain those and perhaps the power limits of those things.
Okay.
Again, it's not my field.
All right.
I'd take a pass on it if you don't mind. I've not studied it.
And have you studied at all the, you know, we have launched, I mean, Cassini and some of these spacecraft we've launched with nuclear power plants on them for satellites for,
oh, yes,
you know,
absolutely, sure.
Sensibly good purpose. But, again, rockets occasionally blow up, and the story they always give us is that it would be safe and that the nuclear power plant would fall safely back to ground, and they would find it, and that would be that. Do you think that's...
Well, these are not, today these are not reactors. What they are is using an isotope of plutonium as a heat source.
Fuel cell, sort of.
As a fuel cell, sort of, yeah. Mm-hmm.
Right. Should that, though, I mean, the question is, should it detonate in the atmosphere?
Well, from what you're thinking of it, just ablating as it comes down through the atmosphere? There'd be no tendency for the thing to explode, put it that way.
Uh-huh.
This is an isotope of plutonium that is not particularly fissionable. It is very radioactive, so it is a good heat source. But its radioactivity again is alpha particles that don't go more than an inch or two away from the surface of the.
I see. So should something like that get scattered in the atmosphere in the worst case scenario, it wouldn't be a problem.
I wouldn't be particular. No, I don't think is. Is a particular worry.
Okay. West of the Rockies, you're on the air with Dr. Till. Hello?
Thank you. Yes.
Yes.
Hello?
Hello. I said at the beginning of the call, you're on the air with Dr. Till. So.
Well, thank you. I'm Bill from Salt Lake, having a 300-year solution for disposal of spent nuclear fuel.
And what is that solution?
We separate by 5-9 is what we call it, 99.999%, and use that for new fuel. And the balance, the fission waste, becomes Class C in 300 years. I could mention names if it's all right.
No, I'd rather you don't, actually. But
okay,
let's ask Dr. Till if he's familiar with this process, Doctor.
I think so. It's not different in concept than the IFR. The idea of trying to get all the man-made materials out of the waste so you're just left with fission products is an excellent idea. I mean, it's more than just an idea. It should be done, in my view. And it simply depends on whether one has in hand a chemical process that will do that in the first place, and secondly, a reactor that will then burn up the man-made elements as we were proposing for the IFR. But in principle, obviously, it's a very, in my mind, a very sound idea.
All right. First-time caller line, you're on the air with Dr. Till. Hello.
Hello, Art Bell. It's a pleasure to talk to you. I've been listening for many years driving truck.
Thank you, my friend.
Dr. Till, I was working for the state of Washington, and there were some professional people that would come in out of Hanford during the time when there was a fire over there. And I was privy to some conversations that talked about radioactivity all over the place on the Geiger counters, but when it came out on the news, of course, everything was all fine. And had the opportunity to talk to some people. The storage of radioactive material over there is just, well, it's got a lot of the tribal community, and it's still in an uproar over there in the Hanford area.
Mm-hmm.
So my concern, and maybe you could talk a little bit about it, is that some of these products last for what, 20,000 years or quite a while? What about that story?
Well, yes. First of all, let me ask you, what time period was that?
Within the last 4 years.
Oh, okay. Well, I'm unfamiliar with it, but let me answer the part of the question to do with the long-lived activity. In order for there to be really long-lived activity, you have to have contaminated with americium, curium, neptunium, plutonium, basically those four elements. The only way I could see that at the Hanford site that could have been so is if they if the source of the contamination was the waste tanks there.
Yeah, in fact, I think that's what it was with some of the waste tanks and being close to the river and the fish and
indeed.
The fishing
yes,
community.
Indeed.
Yeah, so anyway, Art was bringing up the question about the fear factor, I guess you might say.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, when I hear things like that and you hear the conversation, what the news media was saying to the public, and as I went to work and would listen to these conversations at the office by professional people that were, you know, talking,
sure.
you know, behind closed doors, I just... My attitude about it is I don't have any trust in the process.
Well, see, there you are, Doctor.
That's exactly what I was talking about. Look, let me say something about those waste tanks. That's the principal worry at Hanford, and a very correct one it is too. I too would be disturbed if I was living there. What was done during wartime and shortly after in the rush to first of all, win the war, very commendable. Secondly, to protect the country against the threats of the Soviet Union, very commendable. But once that was over, those tanks should have been cleaned up. I mean, there's no reason why a huge effort shouldn't have been made to clean those up, in my view. And so I sympathize with the residents there who are saying, that, look, I'll those things are still there.
Yeah.
And
So then, you know, even though that was then and this is now, even now, there are reasons to question perhaps not the pure technology itself, but man's stewardship of it is not a great record.
Well, of course not, Art. I mean, on the you know, you get dumb decisions in every field,
but the decisions that have to do with
how much money goes into the cleanup of the waste tanks and so on are made in Washington D.C. by bureaucrats, and the technical people. I can tell you from experience have very little to say about it.
Well, I hear you, but you know, if they make a decision that's poor regarding some interstate highway, well, then maybe there's something wrong with the road. So I'm trying to say the consequences.
Yeah,
I quite agree with you.
I mean, I more than quite agree. I totally agree with you. I spent a considerable part of my lifetime arguing with these people.
Mm-hmm. Do you get Do you get calls from government people, I mean, to testify, to talk about IFR, to talk about what could be done today if only we would resume?
No. I testified for all of those years in front of all the relevant committees of Congress every year. I got to the point where I knew most of the committee members and certainly the chairman. I would say this, the IFR, they're talking about the politics of the IFR. The senator that led the floor fight against the IFR in 1994 was Senator John Kerry. And I must say at the time I had not heard of him, and I confused him with the other Kerry. But so there is a real political element in all of this, and it hasn't worked to the benefit, I think, of a cool look at what the direction should be in advanced reactor development in this country, given, as we said earlier, the oil difficulties that we're undoubtedly approaching.
Right. All right. You've got a website up. We're just out of time here, but you do have a website up, which we have a link to. What's on there?
What's on there is a public television, WGBH Boston, I was interviewed by a man who won the Pulitzer Prize for the history of the atomic bomb.
Oh, and that interview is on the website.
That interview is on that.
All right, we've got the link up, folks. Dr. Till, we're out of time. Thank you so very much for being here.
Thank you very much, Art, for your informed question.
Have a good night. That's Dr. Charles Till. Tomorrow night, we look toward 2005. Think carefully before you predict. Good night.